So we are wrapping up our series called Family Life. And as I said last week, when it comes to things that we could talk about in regards to family, I mean, the list is a mile long. And so today I'm going to give you one principle related to families and especially parenting, but it's going to take me a little while to get there. Because what I want to try to do today is to stretch your thinking and stretch my thinking outside of our current family environment. Because when I think about families and when you think about family, we tend to think like Westerners, and we tend to think of our immediate families. In other words, if I were to ask you, tell me about your family, you would probably tell me about, you know, whether or not you're married. You would tell me maybe about your brothers or sisters, and then perhaps you would tell me about your kids, and you would stop right there. But in many parts of the world, if you said, tell me about your family, they would tell you about their great-grandfathers and their grandfathers and then their fathers, and then maybe they would tell you about their kids. But then they would even talk about the future. So unfortunately, in our Western way of thinking, family is all about right now. But here is something that you know, that for the most part, you are who you are today because of your parents. And that has a great effect on the way that you parent your kids. But your parents are who they are in large part because of their parents and their grandparents. And chances are, because you're a father or a mother or an aunt or an uncle, you're going to influence not only your kids and your nieces and your nephews, but you'll have an influence on the generation after that. We are who we are today because of the people who came before us. And we are in the process, right? Whether you're intentional about it or not, whether you actually stop to think about it or not, we are a part of shaping the next generation of our families by what we say and by what we do. Now, I bet if you spent a few minutes thinking about it, you could think of someone or think of a story in your past where a grandparent, because you probably knew either one or both your grandparents or maybe a great-grandparent, but there's a story about your great-grandparent that influenced your grandparents, that influenced your parents. And to some degree, you could even begin to understand why you are who you are today because of the previous generations. Now, this is a big deal to me because of the story that I'm going to tell you. Hey, you are who you are because of the family that came before you. And the family that comes after you, all right, kids, grandkids, nieces, nephews, grandnieces, grandnephews, they will be who they are in large part based on your influence. Now, the best illustration I know of this actually occurs in the scriptures. And as I told you last week, that the problem with this whole series is that there really aren't a whole lot of great examples when it comes to family in the Bible. I mean, if you want to read about dysfunctional family, read the Old Testament. It is so dysfunctional because there are some really, really bad examples of families gone wrong in there. But there is one story that is so remarkable. The problem with this story, and the reason you probably never heard the story the way I'm about to tell it today, is because it actually covers about 60 years. Right? It covers about two-thirds, a little over half of the entire book of Genesis. Now, the second half of the story is something you're familiar with. Right, and the second half of the story is somewhat miraculous, but the second half of the story doesn't make complete sense unless you understand the first half of the story. But it illustrates this power of generational parenting, and it illustrates the power of thinking in terms of what kind of a legacy am I leaving to the next generation. So I want to tell you that part of the story that you know, and then I want to go back and tell you the part that maybe you have never connected the dots with before. If you're not a church person, this may be all new to you. I'm going to cover it kind of quickly, but I would dare you, all right, even if you don't have a Bible, even if you don't believe the Bible is true, if you don't have a Bible, just grab one of those blue ones in the chairs around you and take it home. I mean, it's a gift to you. Or you can go on your mobile app or on your phone and download the YouVersion Bible app for free. But I would dare you to find a Bible, okay, turn to the book of Genesis and read the parts I'm about to tell you because this will keep you up at night. It is so exciting. Now, the story begins with the most famous family in all the world. Right, a family that just about everybody in every part of the world has heard of or knows about. It begins with the family of Abraham, who had a couple of sons. And one of his sons was Isaac. Right, Isaac had two sons known as Jacob and Esau if you grew up in church. Right, but it was actually Esau and Jacob because they were twins. Right, and Esau came out first. He was the born first, so he was considered to be the firstborn. As the oldest son, he had some extraordinary opportunities. Because as the older son in that culture, it meant that you got a double share of the inheritance compared to all of your brothers and sisters. And it also meant that you were the judge of your family. right? That you were the authority. So when dad died, you were actually the rule maker of the entire clan. Now, Jacob, he had 12 sons. And his most famous son was, in fact, Joseph, right? And this is the story that many of us grew up hearing. That's such a powerful story. But when Joseph was about 17 years old, he discovered early on that his brothers, and all of them had been born except for the youngest, Benjamin, but all of these sons, all of these brothers pretty much hated him. And the reason they hated him, and here's that whole biblical parenting example problem, the reason they hated him is because Joseph was the son of his father's favorite wife. Now, there's something, right? Right? Honey, you're my favorite wife. Well, gee, thank you, you know, and you're my second favorite wife, and you're not my favorite, you're my third, you know, and your kids aren't my favorite because you're not, you know, and it just got really, really weird. So Joseph is the son of Jacob, and he came from Jacob's favorite wife. Now, all these other kids we'll get to in just a minute, but Joseph was the favorite, right? Joseph was the favorite. So one day Jacob says to Joseph, Joseph, I want you to go out and check on your brothers because they're always up to no good, and I just want you to go out and check on them. And generally speaking, Joseph would come back to Jacob, his dad, and say, Dad, you know, they're up to it again. And so on this particular occasion, and you've probably heard this story, his 10 older brothers are all out there doing their thing. Joseph goes out to where they're supposed to be. They're not there. He finds out where they are. He goes to where they are. They see him coming. And they say to themselves, here comes that dreamer. Right? Here comes the rat. Right? Here comes that fink. Here comes the guy that's just going to go back to Dad and say, Dad, they're doing it again. Right? Whatever it was they would do to get into trouble. So they had decided that they had had enough. And they decided, let's just kill him. Right? Let's just be done with this once and for all. So when Joseph arrives, you know, smiles and all, they take him, they strip off his robe, and they throw him into an empty well to decide what to do with him. And then while they're having lunch, they are just overwhelmed by mercy, and they decide, well, let's not kill him, but let's sell him into slavery. Right? Let's tell our parents that he was killed, but sell him into slavery. Right? That's even better. We'll make some money on the side. And so, sure enough, they sell him to some slave traders. They break their father's heart. They go back and they say, you know, what can we say? Father Jacob, you know, we found his robe, but there was some blood on it, the blood of an animal and his blood mixed in. You know, it looks like it was a terrible fight. I'm sure he did his best. But your favorite son from your favorite wife is dead. And they sell their brother into slavery. And now he's on his way to Egypt. Now, when you read Bible stories and when we hear ancient stories, we all tend to kind of romanticize them a little bit because we can't smell it, right? We can't see it. We can't even sometimes maybe even comprehend it. But here is a 17-year-old boy, right? So imagine Trey Nelson, right? Trey Nelson handcuffed behind a camel train, right? Being dragged across the desert, right? He has grown up with slaves, so he knows what the life of a slave can be like. He knows that his life as he knows it is now over. He's not sure if he will even make it to Egypt. He has no idea who he's going to be sold to and no idea what he's going to do for the rest of his life. Somehow, he makes it safely to Egypt, and he's sold to a man named Potiphar, who was actually one of the captains of the guard of Pharaoh, right? So a very powerful man. So he kind of lucked out there. And when he went into Potiphar's house, we discover something very interesting about Joseph. Joseph decided to live his life as if God was with him when it seemed like God had abandoned him. At every turn, we find Joseph doing the right thing, even though right things never happened for him. And he continues to live as if God was with him, even though fate kind of seems to take him into the strangest places. And as he begins to gain favor in the eyes of his master, he also gains the attraction of Potiphar's wife. Right, so Potiphar's wife comes to Joseph and says, Joseph, I want you to be my boy. I want you to be my guy. And Joseph's like, no, I can't do that. And he says, and it's kind of funny, it would dishonor my master, your husband. Right? You're married, you remember that? And it would also dishonor, and get this, my God. It would dishonor my God. To which we would say, well, wait a minute, time out, Joseph. What God is that? I mean, the God that allowed your brothers to sell you instead of killing you? The brothers who stole your life from you? The God who did nothing to protect you? And Joseph decided to do the right thing. So Potiphar's wife frames him and claims, this Hebrew boy tried to rape me. Right? He's a slave. I mean, who's going to listen to a slave? And so Joseph, who's innocent, is thrown into the dungeon. Now, it's bad to be in the dungeon. Right? It's bad to be a slave. It's bad to be a slave in the dungeon because you're not waiting for a court date. Right? You're not waiting for a court-appointed attorney like Randy Tilton who's going to take your case on. Right? You're just waiting forever. And yet, Joseph continues to live like a man who God was with, even though it seemed like God had abandoned him. He continued to do the right thing, even though the right things never happened for him. And then we run into this very strange verse in the book of Genesis that summarizes this stage of Joseph's life. And here's what it says. The Lord was with him, which is good. Right? He showed him kindness, also good. And granted him favor, which is good. In the eyes of the prison warden. Now, listen, if God is with you, you do not have a personal relationship with the prison warden. I mean, if God is with you, you really don't care what the prison warden thinks because you don't want to know the prison warden. So there's this tension of, the good news is, Joseph, I'm with you, but yeah, we're in prison. I don't want to have favor with the prison warden. That just means that every once in a while he throws me an extra slice of bread. I mean, big deal. This isn't evidence that God is with me. Right? This isn't evidence that I've been favored with God and that God is being kind. And yet Joseph continues to do what anyone would do who believed that God was with him, even though it seemed like God had abandoned him. Where did that come from? Well, where did that kind of faith come from? Well, time goes on, and eventually Pharaoh gets mad at a couple of his guys, and he throws them into the dungeon as well. And while they're in the dungeon, they meet Joseph. And Joseph interprets their dreams. One of the dreams is by the cupbearer. And he says to the cupbearer, he says, look, you're going to be restored to Pharaoh, right? That's what your dream means. And the guy says, well, that's amazing. And Joseph says, look, when you're restored, I want you to do me a favor. Would you tell somebody that I'm down here? Right? Nobody knows I'm here. I've been here for years. I'm going to die in this dungeon. 2 years later, right? 2 years later, Pharaoh has a dream and nobody can interpret the dream. And Pharaoh knows that this is an important dream that has to have an interpretation. Suddenly the cupbearer, you know, kind of comes to his senses and is like, oh yeah. And he says, you know, sir, pardon me, sir, right? But do you remember that thing, you know, a couple years ago? Let's not get into that. Right? Anyway, I ended up in the dungeon, you know, I deserve that and all. But while I was there, I met a boy who interpreted my dream and predicted that I would be restored to your service. And sure enough, here I am. Perhaps he can interpret your dream, O great one. The next thing you know, they're down in the dungeon trying to go through the roster. Is there a Hebrew boy down here by the name of Joseph? And Joseph kind of raises his hand and he doesn't know what's going on. They bring him up out of the dungeon. They shower him. They clean him up a little bit. They shave him, you know, probably cut his hair, probably pierce his ear, maybe even give him a couple tattoos. By the time it's over, he looks like he belongs in that culture. Right? And they bring him into the palace and into the throne room, and he is now standing before the most powerful man in all the world, the Pharaoh. The Pharaoh says from his great big giant throne, he says, young man, I have heard that the gods are with you and that you can interpret dreams. And then Joseph says the dumbest thing imaginable. He says, no, I can't, but my God may be able to give Pharaoh an interpretation of his dream. And everybody in the courtroom kind of gasped. It's like, who in the world would talk to a guy who is known to be a god himself in such a way? Right, Joseph's words communicated that there is one great God, Pharaoh, to whom you are accountable. And the palace guards kind of reach for their swords, and Pharaoh stops them. And he says, no, I need to know the interpretation of this dream. And he tells Joseph of the dream. And Joseph says, I've got it. All right, here's what your dream means. For the next 7 years, Egypt is going to have such a bountiful harvest that you're not going to know what to do with it all. All right, the following 7 years, there's going to be a famine. And it's going to destroy the economy of this great nation and even the entire surrounding area. So you're going to have 7 years of plenty, and then you're going to have 7 years of famine. And then Joseph does the unthinkable. He doesn't just stop it with interpretation. He begins to give Pharaoh advice. He says, now, I realize I'm not from here. You know, I realize you just kind of brought me up out of the dungeon. You could probably still smell jail on me. But let me give you some advice, O great Pharaoh. here's what you need to do. You need to find a really, really strong administrator. Right? You need to put him in charge of a project, and you need to build grain silos in every single major city in the nation. And you need to tax the people 20% of all the grain. Right? You just take it as a government. Put it in the grain silos and save it for 7 years. And then what's going to happen is your people are going to run out of grain. And then you, Pharaoh, you're going to be able to sell the grain back to their people, and it is going to make you unbelievably wealthy. All right, eventually, people from all the surrounding areas are going to find out that you're the only guy in town with grain, and they're going to come to you, and you're going to become so wealthy by the time this thing is over, it's going to be ridiculous. But you have got to find somebody who is really, really sharp. Right? They've got to wake up every single day thinking about this project because you only have 7 years. And all the scribes are going, that's a great idea. And Pharaoh kind of looks at them, well, what do you think, guys? Well, that's a great idea. Pharaoh says to Joseph, I'm putting you in charge. And all the scribes are like, what? Are you kidding me? I mean, we don't even know this guy. We just brought him out of the dungeon. Who is he? He's not even from here. Pharaoh says, can we find a greater, wiser man in all of my kingdom? And on that day, Joseph becomes the prime minister of Egypt and the second in command. God was obviously with Joseph. So he goes to work, and he does his job, and sure enough, there's so much grain that the crops are so bountiful in that area, they can't even eat it all, right? They can barely save it all. Now, he goes around the countryside, building all these silos, filling them with grain, and on January 1st, the beginning of the eighth year, it all comes to an end. Nobody can grow anything, and the people begin to starve. And Joseph, who's in charge of saving all this grain, he begins to distribute grain to the people of Egypt. Finally, word gets outside of Egypt that there is food in Egypt. And people begin coming from all around the world, all around that region, to buy grain from the Egyptians. 2 years into this famine, right? 2 years into this famine, Joseph's dad and brothers have run out of food. And they have no choice but to go down to Egypt to buy food. I mean, it is an amazing story. You should read your Bible. Now, here's what happens. So Israel's, right, Jacob's sons, right, remember Joseph, or Jacob is Joseph's father. By this time, God had changed his name to Israel, so that's where Israel came from, an interesting little Bible fact. Right, but Israel's sons were among those who went to buy grain, for there was famine in the land of Canaan also. Now, Joseph was the governor of the land, the person who sold grain to all his people. So when Joseph's brothers arrived, they bowed down to him with their faces to the ground. As soon as Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them. Now, Joseph is 29 years old at this point. Right? It's been 22 years since he last saw his brothers, and there they are, bowed down before him. But he also remembered something else, a scene from his childhood. And Joseph connected the dots. Right? And this is the part of the story that never seems to get connected. So now we've got to rewind and go back many, many years. Right? Remember, there's Abraham, there's Isaac, and then there's Esau and Jacob. When Esau and Jacob were teenagers, maybe middle school age, maybe high school age, when Esau and Jacob were teenagers, they were twin brothers, but they were very, very different. Okay, Esau was an outdoorsman. He loved to hunt and fish. Jacob was an extraordinary cook. He just had different skills. And one day, Genesis tells us that when these two brothers were teenagers, Esau had been out hunting for several days, and he had nothing to show for it. And he's starving to death. And he comes home, and he smells something great cooking in the kitchen. He walks into the kitchen, and here's his brother Jacob stirring this pot of stew. And Esau says, oh, Jacob, Jacob, I got to have some of your stew. I'm going to starve to death. I'm going to die. Now, this is a rare moment for a younger brother, because younger brothers never have an opportunity to leverage anything against older brothers. Right? Older brothers never need anything from younger brothers. But in this moment, suddenly, the older needs something from the younger. And Jacob, the smart younger brother, does what every younger brother does in this situation. He says, okay, let's see what I can get out of this. All right, let's start the bidding as high as I possibly can and see what I can get. So as he's stirring this big old pot of stew, he says, maybe even kiddingly, he says, okay, let's make a trade. I'll trade you a bowl of stew for your birthright. I mean, seriously, I'll give you a bowl of stew for your birthright. Now, the birthright, as I said, meant that he would inherit over half of everything from his very wealthy father. Right? Birthright meant that he would have, you know, maybe even two or three or four times as much wealth as his older brother. And Esau, as a teenager, you know, frontal lobe not fully developed yet, you know, very, very hungry. It's all about, you know, right now, immediate gratification. So he says to his brother Jacob, deal. And he trades his birthright for a bowl of stew. Now, the Bible tells us that on that day, Esau despised his birthright. And he ate the stew, and the stew was gone, but so was the most valuable thing he had as the older brother. Little time goes by, and we don't know if it was weeks or perhaps months, and their father, Isaac, is very, very old, and he begins to lose his eyesight. And it's time now for the brothers to go before Isaac, actually all the children, to go before Isaac for a blessing. Now, a blessing was a legally binding ceremony. Whatever the father said was legally binding in those days. And part of the blessing for the older brother was that Isaac would lay his hands on his older son, Esau, and he would bestow upon him the authority of judge over all the family. That whoever blesses you will be blessed, whoever curses you will be cursed, and you will lord it over your family. You are now taking my role as the patriarch over this entire clan. And Jacob, with the help of his mother, sneaks in before Esau into a dark room. They cover his arms with fur so that he'll feel like his brother Esau. And he sneaks in, and he lowers his voice, and he says, I'm Esau, and I've come for the blessing. And his father, Isaac, is a little confused, and he's like, well, you don't sound like Esau. And Jacob swears, and he says, no, I'm Esau, your eldest. And his father lays his hands on him, and he gives him the blessing. And he gives them the authority and the power of the firstborn. He leaves, and soon after that, Esau comes in for the blessing. And again, his father is confused, and he's like, oh, I'm sorry, son, I've already given the blessing. I can only do it once, and I gave it to the one who was in here before you. And now Esau is angry with his brother. He has stolen everything that was rightfully his, and there's nothing he can do about it. Genesis tells us this. Esau held a grudge against Jacob because of the blessing his father had given him. He said to himself, the days of mourning, all right, talking about the fact that their father was about to die soon. The days of mourning for my father are near. Then I will kill my brother Jacob. As soon as my father dies, I'm going to kill my brother Jacob. And when I kill my brother Jacob, the birthright is mine again. When I kill my brother Jacob, the blessing is mine again. And I will not bow down to my younger brother. Word gets back to Jacob, it's not going well. All right, you've got until your father dies to get out of Dodge, or you will join him in the next life. And so Jacob runs for his life. He leaves that area, he leaves that country, he goes to live with one of his uncles. And his uncle has two daughters, right? And he's gone for over 20 years, just a little over 20 years. During that time, Jacob marries Leah, and then he marries Rachel, right? Leah is the younger sister, and Rachel is the older sister. And Rachel would become his favorite wife that we mentioned earlier. So Leah starts having kids. He has a boy, she has a second boy, she has a third boy, and a fourth boy. Rachel, she can't get pregnant. And there's all this jealousy going on. So Rachel says, here, take my maidservant, and if she has a baby, it will be my baby. So the next thing you know, every time he comes home, I mean, you should read this, but every time he comes home, there's a different woman waiting for him. And she's like, we got to have a kid. And he's like, all right, twist my arm, you know. So by the time it's over, he's got four women, 11 sons over the course of about 20 years. But you should read it for yourself. So anyway, this happens for 20 years. Not only that, Jacob becomes incredibly wealthy. He becomes so wealthy, his herds become so large, he can't even stay in the area because there isn't enough land to feed all of his herds. And the other people in that region, his uncle's family, are saying that there's too many of you people and there's too many herds. You've got to go somewhere else. So after 20 years, God speaks. Then the Lord said to Jacob, go back to the land of your fathers. Right, that would be Abraham, Isaac, and Esau. And to your relatives. And I will be with you. To which no doubt Jacob probably thought, well, you had better be with me, because if Esau is the same Esau I left 20-something years ago, not only is he going to kill me, he's going to kill all my sons, and he's going to take my wives as his wives. And so he packs up his family and all of his herds and all of his slaves and both of his wives, and all 11 of his children, and they begin to make their long journey back to the land of his fathers. Esau hears that they are coming. Here's what happens next. Jacob looked up, and there was Esau coming with his 400 men. Not 400 people, right? 400, and I brought my wives and kids so we could all meet the cousins. No, 400 men, a small army. So Jacob knows what's about to happen, and it's too late to do anything about it. So he divided the children among Leah, right? That's his first wife, Rachel's younger sister, and Rachel, favorite wife, and the two female servants that these two women kept throwing at him to have children. He put the female servants and their children in front. Leah, second favorite wife, you went too far there, Randy. But anyway, he put the female servants and their children in front. Leah, his second favorite wife, and her children next. Now, again, I had read this before, but the first time this actually stuck out to me, I mean, it just floored me. Right? He put Leah's children next, and Rachel and Joseph in the rear. Right? Joseph is the only one of the 11 sons who is mentioned by name. Right? He put Joseph and Rachel in the rear. And as we're about to find out, in the rear doesn't mean miles away. In the rear simply means at the end of this long wagon train, you know, camel caravan, so that everybody can still see what's happening. As he gets close to Esau, the brother who's going to kill him, the writer of Genesis says, Esau ran to meet Jacob and embraced him. He threw his arms around his neck and kissed him, and they wept. This, no doubt, became a story that Joseph heard all of his life. The day that your uncle Esau spared your father's life. And oh, by the way, Joseph, he also spared your life and your mother's life. And Joseph, you know the story, right? Your father deserved anything that Uncle Esau chose. But on that day, there was a reconciliation between two brothers that no one expected, that no one deserved. And Joseph, that's why you're alive today. And now, 30-something years later, there stands Joseph with his own brothers bowing down before him with their faces to the ground. And he's got the power of life and death in his hands. And he chooses to do for them what he saw his uncle do for him. He chooses in a moment of crisis, right? And he chooses in a moment of extraordinary emotion, I mean extraordinarily conflicting emotions, he chooses to do what he saw done for him. And he chooses to do what the story he grew up hearing was all about. And he extended mercy to brothers who deserve no mercy. Story continues. You should read it for yourself. Eventually, he lets them know, you know, I may walk like an Egyptian, I may talk like an Egyptian, but I am a Hebrew and I'm your brother, baby. And they looked up and oh my gosh, through all that makeup, through all that garb that they saw, it's our 17-year-old brother. And they were scared to death. Now, there's a part of the story when Joseph gathers them all in his arms, and they all weep together. He says, you may have intended this for evil, but God has intended it for good. And he restored the relationship he provided for their family. And even when their father is dead and gone, when they assume that he would finally get his revenge, he said, no, this is for your good. This is what my God would have me do. So what does all this have to do with family life? Moms, dads, grandpas, grandmas, it's this. Your actions will always, always, always speak louder than words. Your children are watching the way you live and how you make Jesus a part of your life. Your children see how you act on Friday and Saturday nights, and then how you act on Sunday mornings. What your children and what your grandchildren and what your nieces and what your nephews see you do will lay the groundwork for what they do in times of crisis. They will forget just about everything we say. They will not forget who we are and what we are. Right? They will never forget what we did when the right thing was difficult to do. Right? When staying was difficult. When running away would have been the easier thing to do. when not paying our debts would have been the easier thing to do, when mishandling our money would have been the easier thing to do, when not apologizing would have been the easier thing to do, when not following Jesus would have been the easier thing to do. They won't remember what we say, but they will remember who we are, and they will remember what we do. So dads, grandfathers, think about it. All right, what if what you do is how your sons, how your grandsons will live their lives? What if the thing that you do, what if it's you that they look to as their pattern? All right, dads, what if you're the role model for how they treat your future daughter-in-law and how they treat a wife? What if you're the model for how they raise your grandchildren? What if you're the model for how they deal with extraordinary sin, temptation, and money? What if you're the model for how they respond in moments of crisis? What if they take their cues from you? Odds are very, very strong that they will. Moms, what if your daughters decided to take their cues from you about how they treat, talk to, and respond to your future son-in-law and how they treat a husband? And what if they model you in terms of how they raise your grandchildren? And what if they take their cues from you in how you view money, your worldview, right? How you respond to the call of God, how you respond to the whole issue of faith and following Jesus? What if they take their cues from you? Right, you are now determining what your future family or what future generations are going to do. Most of us won't be around to see the full effects of our decisions. But rest assured, decisions will be made with the imprint of your life in mind. All right, bottom line, actions, they don't merely speak loud in the words. All right, sometimes they echo into the next generation. All right, your actions, of course they speak loud in the words. But it's not just about here and now. Right? It's not just about the next 10 or 15 years. Actions speak loud in the words, but you're going to have some actions and you're going to do some things that will echo into the next generation. The question for me as a father, who maybe, hopefully by God's grace, will become a grandfather, who maybe one day will become even a great-grandfather whose great-grandchildren will never remember me, well, what will echo from my life into my future generations? Will they remember what Grandpa did? Will the way I followed Jesus impact my future generations? You better believe it will. To use an incredibly rich term, what will your legacy be? What will that dash on your tombstone represent? And what will echo from your life into the next generation? Because yes, actions speak louder than the words, but it's bigger than that. It's broader than that. It's more powerful than that. It means you have a greater opportunity than perhaps you have never imagined, because you can make decisions now. Right? You can set priorities now. Right? You can manage your money now. You can respond to temptation now. Right? You can respond to relational issues now in such a way that it will reverberate into your grandkids. If this is true, what should you do? If this is true, what should you do differently? If this is true, what should you change? If this is true, why wouldn't you change? And why wouldn't we change it as soon as possible? Do you remember what Grandpa did? You bet I do. Because his actions always spoke louder than words. Let's pray together. Heavenly Father, that is such an overwhelming thought. For those in our church with little kids, and it's all they can do to get to the end of the day. I mean, they love nap times and bedtime, and that's about as far as they can think. Father, give them a vision for what's to come. How they live and act as parents has a much greater impact upon their children than what they say. Father, for the marriages that may be struggling and those who are even contemplating divorce, Father, I pray that you would give them clarity as to how to live unselfishly. Because our decisions not only impact us, but our children and the legacy we leave behind. Father, I pray that our story, the stories of our families, would be worth telling to our grandkids and great-grandkids, that we decided to put down some markers, to set some priorities that not only impacted our immediate family, but our future family. Father, help us as a church to live so differently, so sacrificially, that our community would take notice of it. Give us each the strength, the courage, and the wisdom to do what we need to do. It's in Jesus' amazing name that we pray. Amen.